And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and I'm Phil Taylor. And today we're going to be talking to Zafar Bengash of crescent-online.net about these developments in Libya, Syria, Egypt, around the Middle East. And then later in the program, we're going to talk to Tiki Mercury Clark, who is a marvelous singer, and she's going to talk about the origins of gospel music and spirituals. And that should be about the halfway point. But now I think we are already joined by Zafar Bengash of Crescent. Are you there, Zafar?
Yes. Hello, Phil. I am.
Thank you very much for joining us, Zafar. We, of course, have been checking in with you and because of your expertise. And maybe I should start off by saying our listeners, I'm sure, are a little frustrated trying to understand the events that are taking place in the Middle East. For example, I saw a good headline, I thought, today, Monthly Review Press. They said, Arab Spring, Royal Summer, Islamic Autumn, indicating there's a lot of other matters going on here, that the word spring doesn't quite get it.
Yes.
If we could start with the one that's getting the most headlines at the moment, and there's a kind of, you can tell there's a kind of fever starting to run through the veins of the great powers, and that has to do with Syria. And the first thing, I want to know your impression. The reporting I see tends to either deny or minimize the fact that there seems to be armed elements in Syria, in particularly in a couple of areas, who have actually killed policemen, killed soldiers, which would indicate, an incipient civil war. But the media here tends to talk about them only as demonstrators, and certainly people who are their advocates and are very much against Mr. Assad, want to see him overthrown. They continually say, well, his army is just assaulting civilians. What's your view of that?
Yeah, you're right. Actually, the manner in which the situation in Syria is being presented, it is as if there is a popular mass uprising and the regime is involved in wholesale slaughter. We need to clarify a few things. Number one, that as you mentioned, there are several areas where within the people's uprisings, there are armed groups, heavily armed groups. You mentioned one particular area where, in fact, in June, 123 Syrian policemen were massacred. Now, 123 policemen being killed in a matter of a couple of hours is not a small matter.
No, that's a serious military operation. Absolutely. Involving skills.
Absolutely, exactly. Now, who were these people that carried out the slaughter of 123 policemen in that area, which incidentally is close to the Turkish border? And that's where a lot of the refugees had fled from, because the refugees realized that when so many policemen are killed in one operation, the government is bound to take action, and the people fled. And even that exodus of the people, about 10,000-12,000 of them that fled to Turkey, it was presented as if it is the Syrian regime that has forced them out, whereas in fact that was not the case. The Syrian army or security forces had not yet arrived in the area when the people started to flee, because they realized that something really serious had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, getting 123 police officers killed in one shot is, to say the least, it's a very, very serious issue.
Sure, for a local civilian, it would mean that your life is at hazard because you don't know now who's going to be ruling you.
Exactly. So that was one incident, but there have been a number of others where, I mean, there is ample evidence available that before the Syrian uprising began, that there were meetings in Paris at which the Saudis, the Americans, even the American ambassador to Israel, Dan Shapiro, was present at that meeting, including the Saudi security advisor to the king, Bandar bin Sultan, who was a former ambassador here in Washington, he was present, and there were a number of other Syrian exiles. And this information actually was released by Maysam Manna, who is the chair of the Arab Human Rights Commission. Mm-hmm. He was also invited to that meeting, and he, according to his own statement, he was shocked at what he heard at the meeting, that the exiled Syrian businessmen, some discredited Lebanese politicians, there is a Lebanese a former MP, his name is Farid Ghadiri. He leads the so-called Reform Party in Lebanon, and he has actually issued statements in which he says that Palestine belongs to Israel, and that, you know, Israel should keep the whole of Palestine. Now, you would begin to wonder, how could a Lebanese politician say or make statements like that unless he was deeply involved with the Israelis or on their payroll? And in fact, he's among the few Lebanese politicians to have visited Israel. So you can see, begin to see the kinds of forces that are operating over there against the Syrian government. Now, let me add, I mean, I would in no way wish to exonerate the Syrian security forces from killing civilians. I'm sure that there are better ways to deal with that situation. But what we find is that when there are there is an armed insurrection against the government, I'm not quite sure exactly what the government is supposed to do, to just surrender and hand over everything?
Exactly. You know, I mean, the father of the President Assad is widely associated with the repression in a decision to repress the city of, I guess it was
Hama.
Hama.
Yes.
And at that time, they really did go into the city.
Yes.
So the impression I have of reading the accounts I've seen is that they tried to stay on the outskirts so as to avoid the kind of confrontation where you would have massive loss of life.
That's correct, yes.
That's the impression. And when they give us figures of 100 or 150, that's bad. But that is not on the scale of what you would get if you entered a city determined to smash somebody.
That's correct, yes. And also, you know, the nobody has any exact figures. You know, you hear all kinds of figures ranging anything from, let's say, 27 people killed to 200 people killed in one particular area in a day, depending on who gave these figures. Now, surely that's a very vast spread, almost 1 to 10. The difference in the figures that are being quoted. And what I notice is that over here, we are getting media reports that tend to go for the higher figures all the time.
Yes.
And this is because whenever they don't a particular government or a particular ruler, then there is an attempt to exaggerate his misdeeds.
Mm-hmm.
And if the ruler happens to be a Western puppet, such as in, let's say, Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or whatever, then the figures are downplayed. And they also say, well, you know, the opposition always exaggerates figures. So they will add that rider to it. Mm-hmm. In the case of Syria, we see that figures, outlandish figures are being given. What is also not mentioned is that, you know, Bashar al-Assad, despite the fact that he is obviously not a democratically elected ruler, but he does enjoy widespread support in Syria. There have been rallies in his favor.
Yes, big ones, yes.
Very big ones, and yet they have either been ignored or, in the case of Al Jazeera, I mean, it's really surprising that Al Jazeera would use those rallies to say that these are anti-government rallies.
Yes, they've actually put the photos of those people in Damascus with the flag, where they set a record, I think, for the length of the flag.
Yes.
And then they said that was the opposition.
Yes, it was 2.3 kilometers long, that flag.
Amazing.
Can you imagine? And that's people underneath the flag. So you can see how many people were there. And they said that is an opposition rally, whereas in fact it was a rally in support of Bashar al-Assad. So we have a situation whereby there are massive rallies in support of the government, and the government has made some efforts. For instance, it has offered to the opposition to sit with them and to sit and have a dialogue. The government has proposed that elections would be held in September, and all political parties are free to participate. Early last month, in fact, there was a meeting in Damascus at which a number of opposition groups and their leaders were present. It was a full-day meeting, and the entire conference was broadcast live on Syrian television, in which people criticized the government, they criticized Bashar al-Assad, and nobody censored that. And at the end of the day, they said, well, look, you know, we need to have this matter resolved through a dialogue. But interestingly, the groups that are sitting outside, they are the ones that insist on no dialogue.
Yes.
They say that, well, unless Bashar al-Assad resigns, there can be no compromise, no dialogue, no talk with the government, etc.
And when they do meet, they invite as special guests representatives of the U.S. and British governments.
That's correct, yes.
And we're talking to Zafar Benkash. You should go to his website, crescent-online.net, where you can find commentary and information of this sort. And Zafar, I saw a report, and again, it's the old thing of fairness. I mean, the media is... We have to look at all reports and try to assess what the reality is. Now, Syria has shown photographs of captured weapons, and they said they came from Lebanon, and they've identified the people who brought them. A lot of weapons. Now, you mentioned there are people there in Lebanon. I recall reading, I think at Press TV, the Iranian outlet, that the family members of the Hariri family, who are intimately tied to the by marriage to the Saudis,
yes,
are operating as a very definite part. It's only logical that they would try to ship weapons. And people, why aren't they talked about in that way? What are they doing? They're obviously trying to overthrow Mr. Assad.
Yes, of course. The Hariris were also, their representatives were also present in that meeting in Paris that was held earlier this year. And their representative, in fact, was given a specific task that he had to coordinate with the Saudis and the Jordanians and the opposition figures in Syria.
Two monarchies insisting on a democracy.
Isn't that incredible? You know? So, yes, and in fact, you know, the they also had, for instance, as I mentioned earlier, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Dan Shapiro, as well as the Undersecretary of State for that region, Jeffrey Feltman, and even an Emirati prince. Who had, in fact, provided certain mobile phone networks to the Syrian opposition groups that were using UAE SIM cards and Jordanian SIM cards so that they would not be blocked in Syria. And so you can see that there is a much broader conspiracy underway.
Very ambitious.
Exactly. I mean, you know, I want to, I mean, emphasize. I think people shouldn't get the impression that I am opposed to the rights of the Syrian people. By no means. I mean, naturally, the Syrian people deserve their rights. But I'd be very suspicious of people that are working with the Israelis and the Saudis and the discredited Lebanese politicians and Americans to bring about change in Syria.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound to me like an indigenous uprising. It sounds like a foreign-inspired conspiracy, foreign-backed conspiracy.
Yeah, and by the way, there hasn't been a big mystery about this. President Obama, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and certainly Cameron of Britain, said that they have certain targets, that they want regime change. They want regime change in Syria. They want to get rid of Hamas in Gaza. And well, in the West Bank, actually.
Yes.
And they want to also remove Hezbollah, and their ultimate target, because these three are seen as friends of the Islamic Republic. I mean, it's only logical, isn't it, to assume that this is part of that larger plan?
Exactly. In fact, our understanding is that what is taking place in Syria is, on the one hand, you have the Syrian people that are naturally aroused by what they have seen in the rest of the Middle East in terms of the people's movements, etc. But the legitimate grievances of the Syrian people are being exploited by these external players to undermine what is referred to as the resistance front against Israel. So if we look at the pattern starting from 2006, summer of 2006, July, August, when Israel had attacked Lebanon and the aim was to destroy Hezbollah, in which about 1,200 Lebanese civilians were slaughtered, much of Lebanon's infrastructure, particularly areas where Hezbollah had its facilities, its supporters, those areas were actually vandalized and billions of dollars worth of loss was inflicted. Mm-hmm. Although Hezbollah was not militarily defeated, and therefore that was considered a military defeat for Israel because it lost a lot of tanks, it lost a lot of soldiers, mm-hmm. and it failed to achieve its objective. Then the second part of this attack on the resistance front was in December of 2008, January 2009, when the Israelis attacked Gaza. The aim was to wipe out Hamas because they were thought to be a soft target. And again, despite causing massive destruction, the killing of 1,400 civilians, 5,000 homes destroyed in Gaza, I mean, tiny area, and hospitals destroyed, schools bombed, yet Hamas remained intact, and they were not able to defeat that. So the attack or the uprising in Syria is now the third installment, and this is being instigated internally with backing from outside, with arms being smuggled from Lebanon as well as from Jordan, and using the people's grievances against the regime so that they could be exploited. But I don't think that we should have any doubts about the fact that the Americans, the Saudis, the Israelis, the discredited Lebanese politicians who are essentially in league with the Saudis and the Americans are involved in trying to undermine the Syrian government. Because Syria is part of that resistance front together with the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the ultimate objective is to undermine and overthrow the Islamic government in Iran, because that is what is viewed as the real challenge to American hegemony in the region.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for those points. We're speaking to Zafar Benghashian, and just I only have about a minute or two left, but Zafar, I want to ask you, and this is, I should remind everybody, it's crescent-online.net. I need to know what you make of the death of the military commander in Libya under the very peculiar circumstances. And the Globe and Mail, bless their hearts, Graham Smith, saw the funeral, and he said he saw the son of General Yunus saying at the graveside, "We want the green flag back." Now, that hasn't been repeated, but he did write that in the Globe.
Right.
What do you think is going on here?
Well, basically, you see, General Abdel Fattah Yunus was killed by the part of the opposition group in Libya. Of course, he was first accused of being still in contact with Colonel Gaddafi. Now, General Abdel Fattah Yunus, of course, had served as interior minister in the Gaddafi government when he joined the rebels, but he belongs to a very powerful tribe, the Ubaidi tribe. And that tribe and its elders have made absolutely clear that unless and until the culprits are apprehended and brought to justice, we are not going to allow this matter to die out, and that we are going to exact revenge. So it seems to me that the opposition itself is now going to begin to fight, And that's what usually happens with groups that are not really indigenous, but that have foreign backing, and that they begin to fight among themselves. And this tribal warfare in Libya, definitely, the opposition groups certainly will not succeed in that once the tribal warfare erupts, because the Obeidi tribe is a very powerful tribe, and indeed, the Libyan society is a very tribal-based society, and it the whole society functions on the basis of tribal loyalties. So if the tribes begin to fight among themselves, then one can be sure that all of this opposition to Colonel Gaddafi's government is going to crumble very quickly. And in fact, there are signs that it is beginning to crumble, and that their Western sponsors are beginning to lose hope, because they had thought that Gaddafi would be an easy pushover, but he has managed to survive for this long, despite attacks on his residential compound, the killing of his son and grandchildren, and yet Gaddafi has so far survived and been in power, and it doesn't appear likely that he'll be overthrown anytime soon.
It really speaks well of the Arab people and the Libyan people, that they're showing a kind of resilience that the old colonists didn't know they had.
Absolutely. I think the Libyans have a lot going for them. I mean, they have a long history of resisting colonialism. We know of Omar Mukhtar, who had resisted the Italians back in 1911 for quite a while. And ultimately, of course, he was hanged, but he had set a very good example of resisting colonial occupation. And I doubt very much if today's Libyans are going to act any differently.
Well, that's a heartening story. Zafar Benghash, crescent-online.net. We are really grateful. Thank you very much. We look forward
pleasure.
To talking to you again.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye. Zafar Benghash, and we're always happy to speak to him. He's full, complete knowledge of the region that contains all the big stories of the day.